From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, memory, the bio experience should be fascinating, but here's what's happening. Dozens of families who lived in homes that they helped build with their own hands saw their entire neighborhood devastated by a tornado that struck North Texas. Habitat for Humanity, that's a group that organizes volunteers to build homes for the needy, had worked with residents to construct 61 houses in the Rancho Brazos neighborhood that was battered by the twister in Granbury, Texas. Aerial footage taken Thursday showed home after home in Granbury completely demolished, with others severely damaged. Six adults have been confirmed dead after what the National Weather Service said were three tornadoes that swept through the counties in northern Texas. Devastating. Investigators have not ruled out intentional fire being behind the explosions at a fertilizer plant in the small town of West that left 15 people dead in Texas. You remember that story. State Fire Marshal Chris Connolly said the investigators were unable to rule out three possible causes: a spark from a golf cart, an electrical short, or arson. A CME, coronal mass ejection, hurled into space by the X-1 flare on May 15th might deliver a glancing blow to Earth's magnetic field on Friday. NOAA forecasters estimate a 40% chance of polar geomagnetic storms when the cloud arrives. X-flares are big. X-1 is as small as the X-flares get, so we were lucky there. X-flare conditions, though, from sunspot AR-1748 already has unleashed four X-class solar flares. It might not be finished. Now, parents, the man who gave America fish sticks is dead at the age of 96. It's one of those foods that parents give their little kids all the time. It's very convenient for them. He's the former General Mills CEO. He passed away May 2nd at the age of 96. He created the fish sticks. His name, of course, was E. Robert Kenney. Less cancer treatment may be better, and being in good physical shape may help keep cancer away, according to the latest research being presented at the largest convergence of cancer experts worldwide. Exercise, they say, may keep cancer away. Getting into shape may help you ward off cancer or boost your survival chances if you are diagnosed, according to this new study. Dr. Leonard Coldwell, of course, author of The Only Answer to Cancer, with us. Leonard, what do you think of that? Exercise preventing cancer.
George, you and I, we talked about this for years. And as you know, I'm a very big proponent of the rebounder, you know, the miniature trampoline, which really helps you to get your blood flow going, get your lymph flow going. And the more oxygen you have in your system, because Otto Warburg and Max Planck both got the Nobel Prize in medicine, proving in 1911 and 1936, if you have enough oxygen in your system, as your body is alkaline, you cannot develop cancer, or cancer cannot grow in our system. So the more you exercise, the more oxygen you have in your system, the more you, of course, have a cancer-fighting mechanism. And on the other hand, in my hospitals in Europe, we use lymph drainage, which means a manual massage of the lymph nodes of the lymphatic system that has the same effect than aerobic exercise. It needs to be aerobic exercise.
So exercise does help.
Absolutely, George, absolutely, because the stronger you are, illness is based on lack of energy. And if you have good sleep, if you have a lot of right exercise, but it needs to be aerobic exercise, very, very important. Tennis and all these anaerobic exercises do not really help. What's good is running, is jogging, is trampoline, it's swimming, it's biking. Everything with short stops like tennis or sports like that can more harm than do good.
Okay. Dr. Coldwell's website, of course, drleonardcoldwell.com, Dr. DR. Thanks, Leonard. Powerball. You into that? The Powerball jackpot for Saturday's drawing will be at least $550 million. It's the third largest jackpot in U.S. history after no one matched the winning numbers in Wednesday night's draw. The largest lottery jackpot in U.S. history, $656 million in the Mega Millions game, March of 2012, split by three tickets sold in Illinois, Kansas, and Maryland. So what would you do if you won the $550? Would you take it all up front, less the taxes, of course, which they discount? or would you take it over 20 years? What do you think? Think about that. You know what we should have done? Every Coast to Coast listener should have sent in $1 and we should have bought all Powerball tickets. And we could have split it with everyone. Oh, well, maybe next time. UFO updates, we get them from Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Let's check in with Peter now. Peter, what's going on these days?
Boy, the planets seem to have aligned to have me on the program tonight. And I'm all, as always, George, I'm grateful to make an appearance.
Of course.
I'm down in Oregon. McMiniman's UFO Festival begins tomorrow in McMinnville, Oregon, and I'm down here for that. Linda Howe is going to be a speaker, Nick Pope, Jim Sparks, and George Knapp, your colleague.
That's right, and Jim Sparks will also be our guest next week on the program.
Oh, good. I didn't know that. I'm looking forward to meeting him. To the best of my knowledge, I've never met him before, but I will meet him probably tomorrow afternoon. But also, we've just posted 950 new reports to our website just this afternoon, George. And I have to tell you, I've talked about volume of reports a lot over the last 10 months or so.
Yeah.
I've just been inundated with reports. But even more important than that, they seem to fall principally in two categories, either sightings of triangles, which is a relatively new development in the field, or the continuing phenomenon of these red, orange, or yellow fireballs that our audience is probably bored to tears about hearing over the last 10 months. I've talked about it a lot, but I'm just being bowled over with reports, many of them from seemingly very good qualified witnesses, airline pilots, police officers, military officers. They're seeing clusters of anywhere from dozens to hundreds of red, orange, or yellow fireballs, and I keep talking about them and probably will until we have some explanation for them. I have no explanation for what's going on. It's a very, very interesting phenomenon, and over the course of 19 years, I've avoided stating any kind of trends that I see, but this is the first one that really has my interest, and I'd like to make an appeal to all the Coast listeners that if they see one of these displays, or if they know anybody who has seen one, please submit a written report using our online report form at ufocenter.com. We would very much like to have the information that may help us solve this, and I encourage people to go to our website and just look at all the hundreds of reports of red, orange, yellow, amber, and gold fireballs, and if anybody has an explanation for them, I would be most grateful if they'd send me an email, director@ufocenter.com, and let me know what their theory is. I have no explanation for it. It's very, very bizarre. I think we may have rounded a corner in the field of ufology, George.
Peter, thank you for the update. Truly appreciate it. As I reported yesterday, the planet-hunting space telescope Kepler has been hobbled by a broken wheel, according to scientists. Two of the four wheels are now faulty. At least three are needed to orient the telescope correctly. In a moment, we will talk with space historian for the hour, Robert Zimmerman, not only about Kepler, this incredible telescope, but some other issues in space next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Robert Zimmerman, award-winning space historian. We're going to react to some things in space, including, of course, NASA's Kepler telescope, which seems to be limping along. Are we going to lose this, Bob?
Hey, George. Well, the press reports and the way NASA has phrased it makes it sound like they might be able to save the telescope for its primary mission, which was staring at 100,000 stars for exoplanets as well as to study the stars. But I got to tell you, no, I don't think so. I don't think they're going back to that primary mission. I think it's really unlikely they'll be able to save this. Just to back up, just to make sure everyone knows, they use what they call reaction wheels. These are a modern version of gyroscopes, and they have a set of – they built four into Kepler, and they needed three to be able to – that's three dimensions, essentially, mm-hmm. to be able to point this telescope with super accuracy, and they need the accuracy to be able to look at these stars to see the very tiny variations in light when a planet moves in front of them. Well, they lost one about a year ago, so they only had three wheels, which meant they had no backup, and one has failed. Now, these are moving parts. They literally produce – you know, they're spinning very fast, and
you get friction in that situation, and that was what was causing problems. They've been worried about this wheel now for about 4 months. In February, they actually shut the telescope down for 10 days to let this wheel rest on the hope that it would improve its operation and lower the amount of friction they were detecting. Instead, it produced more friction, and the result was it failed. And they were expecting this. And so now there's a telescope in space here, and it's an optical telescope. We don't have a lot of these. We have Hubble, and we have Kepler. And Kepler's mirror is a little smaller, and it's not designed to do the kind of work that Hubble does. Without its three reaction wheels, it can't be pointed very precisely. They can use its thrusters to aim it. But that's of limited amount because they'll run out of fuel relatively quick.
That's right.
So there's a limited amount of stuff they can really do with this now. And so that's the sad part. They might get some science out of it in this state, George, but not quite a bit.
Kepler was launched back about 4 years ago.
2009.
Yep.
It had a three-year primary mission. It was supposed to look at this one patch of sky for 3 years with the idea that in 3 years, if there was an Earth-like planet that would cross the face of its star three times in that period of time, they'd be able to find some habitable, potentially habitable exoplanets the size of Earth. And in that and then they got an extension. So they were on the extension of this mission. They got a five-year extension. They were on the second year of that extension. And in the process of this 4.5 some odd years, they have found close to 2,700. I've seen different numbers, but the number I've seen is 2,700 exoplanet candidates, potential exoplanets. And of those, 132 have been confirmed to be exoplanets, actual confirmed. And the difference between unconfirmed and confirmed is that Kepler would see a variation in light. It would see it maybe multiple times, which would consistently in the same way, which would suggest an orbit and an eclipse, transit the star, the planet moving in front of the star. But they wouldn't consider it confirmed unless another telescope using a different technique would get results that matched. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of telescope time. So that's why only 132 out of those 2,700 candidates have been confirmed. What the 2,700 candidates tell you, and of those, something like 300 are Earth-like rocky terrestrial planets, bigger than Earth, some of them smaller. But of those 2,700, they've only been able to get really other telescopes to confirm 132. There is potentially in the archives of Kepler a gigantic motherload of discoveries. And I will tell you, George, that even though Kepler itself might not be able to produce any more new science, it's archive data, which is going to take years to analyze, has probably got some big discoveries hidden in it, and it's going to be producing those discoveries probably for the next decade as they mine that data.
What is the backup to Kepler, Bob?
In terms of doing this kind of exploration in the future?
Do we have anything?
Well, NASA and the astronomy community have been somewhat short-sighted about optical telescopes in space. There is something called TESS. Terrestrial exoplanets, I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's planned for launch in about 5 years, and it's going to do something similar to Kepler, looking at exoplanets and trying to get more information about them. This is the big thing in astronomy right now, without question. I've talked to a lot of astronomers, and the astronomers in the know say this is what astronomy should be focusing on. Studying exoplanets, because they are the most interesting thing out there. We are getting a sense of what our solar system is like. You know, George, there's an aspect of Kepler that very few people talk about. Everyone's focused on the planets it finds, the extrasolar planets. And that's really important because it's teaching us what solar systems are like. But there's another part of Kepler which is equally important, and this is what's really a loss by the telescope dying after 4.5 years, is that it was also looking at 100,000 sun-like stars continuously with great detail and accuracy. And what that's telling us, you mentioned solar flares earlier, tonight. We just got some good X flares from the sun. The sun itself goes through its solar cycle of sunspots. It's going through a remarkably weak solar cycle, the weakest one right now in 200 years. The sun's level of activity influences how much it varies in brightness, which could affect the Earth's climate. And we do not know right now how normal the activity of the sun is. Does a G-star type star like this normally as active as the sun? Are they more active? Do they go through periods of high activity and less, which means they're warmer or cooler? We don't know a lot about stars in this context. And what Kepler was doing was looking at suns like our own sun, and looking at them with great accuracy over a period of time. Now, a lot of these stars have solar cycles like our sun, but our solar cycle is 11 years. Kepler only looked 4.5 years. So it didn't quite get a long enough look to really begin to give us a sense of how other stars like the sun normally behave. And this is really important information, because not only extraterrestrial planets and the solar systems Kepler was finding tell us something about our own solar system and how it fits into the scheme of things, but finding about how other stars like our sun function will tell us a great deal about how our star fits into the scheme of things. And that's really important in terms of climate study, in terms of global warming, in terms of everything, because the sun could be a much more important factor in global warming than climate scientists have considered. And we don't know enough about it yet to really quantify that.
Bob, do you have any doubts that if you can find a planet that has the same kind of primordial soup as Earth, same general temperature, that life somehow, some kind of life is probably on that planet?
Well, you know, if you look at the Earth itself, you would have to say yes to that question. And in fact, compare the Earth to Mars. They talk a lot about how Mars might have microbiological life. But, you know, just look at the pictures the rovers send back of the Martian landscape, and they do not look anything like any spot on Earth, because any spot on Earth you look at, there is no place on Earth you can look at, practically no place, even in Antarctica, where you won't see some life somewhere. It permeates every inch of space on the planet. And so that's what you get on a planet Earth in the habitable zone with lots of water around the star. And every spot of the planet is covered with Earth, you know, and we have extremophiles down 6 miles. You have, the drill mines, they find this, oil drills, and they find biological life deep at the base of the ocean. They find life, you know, in very hostile environments. That's on Earth. So your question is, from my perspective, it seems very likely you would find an alien life developing naturally in these environments. But you know what? I also believe in the fundamental tenets of science, which is that you can't, just because I speculate this doesn't mean it exists. We have to go out and look, and that's what Kepler was making that first attempt at. And it came up with some really – the discovery of Kepler that I love to talk about was one of the most recent ones. It found two different solar systems, George, in which there were three super-Earth-sized planets all in the habitable zone. Now, these were bigger than Earth, two different solar systems. But nonetheless, these were potentially rocky planets, one of which there are some scientists who think it's completely ocean-covered. The circumstances tell them that they would believe it's likely to have a worldwide ocean.
Isn't that exciting?
It's incredible. And once again, we haven't actually found any of that, but we found hints that it's likely to occur. And that's the most exciting part of this. And once again, Kepler is like Hubble. It's giving us that very, very, very first glimpse of what the universe is really like out there. And we are very lucky, I think, to be alive at this time to really get these first glimpses.
Well, I suggest and suspect, Bob, that the solar system has got duplicates all over the universe.
Well, you know what's interesting about all the Kepler and all the exoplanet research, George, is that they thought we would find duplicates of our solar system. What they're instead finding is a plethora of solar systems that don't resemble our solar system in any way, shape, or form. They have planets in the habitable zone, but they don't resemble our solar system. You've got Jupiter's very close to Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Like the two planets are.
Everything's upside down. Yeah.
It's got planets orbiting days from this star. You know, it's like they're roasting. It's very strange.
Yeah,
it is. Very alien, which is cool.
We're going to come back in a second, Bob. We're going to talk more about some things going on in space, take a few phone calls with you. Bob Zimmerman, his latest work, Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, and his website, of course, BehindTheBlack.com, which is linked up for you right there at CoastToCoastAM.com. Nothing like it taking a moment or two to talk about space. So we shall be right back. If you need to email me, by the way, it's always there at George@coast2to, coasttocoastam Bob Zimmerman.com. We shall be right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Bob Zimmerman, our special guest, the space historian, his book, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8. What's the latest with the International Space Station and trying to fix that ammonia leak, Bob?
This was an interesting situation. You know, one of my earlier books, Leaving Earth, was basically talking about how space stations are really nothing more than prototype interplanetary spaceships. You know, if you're going to learn how, if you want to build a ship that's going to keep people alive for the years necessary to get to and from Mars, you basically have to learn how to do such things, and you have to be able to maintain these things from long distances. And what happened last week was an example of a little illustration of how we have to learn how to do this. Because the International Space Station has a series of coolant loops using ammonia, radiators essentially, designed to keep the solar panel, the electrical system, cool. Those solar panels pick up a lot of, you know, they're designed to pick up the sun's rays and turn it to electricity, but the sun carries with it a lot of heat. And so it's got to somehow vent that heat while it turns the light into electricity. Well, one of the cooling systems has given them a lot of problems. It has a slow leak. They've pumped the system filled several times, and that's supposed to keep it going. They tried replacing a pump in the system back last in November of 2012. They did a spacewalk to do that. And then last week, on Monday, about a little over a week ago, it suddenly the astronauts on board noticed a gigantic amount of ammonia flakes, frozen ammonia, floating around the station near that particular system. And so they very quickly improvised a spacewalk for last Saturday, in which two astronauts went out and did an inspection and went out with the plan that even if they couldn't locate the leak itself, they were going to replace the pump again. They had a spare on board. When the shuttle flights were ending, they filled that shuttle with as many spare parts for the station as possible, anticipating problems in the future. And so these guys did a spacewalk, and they replaced them. They couldn't find the leak, but they replaced the pump. And it does appear that that has solved the problem. They've seen no more leakage in the last 4 days. And so today they basically said, we think we solved the problem. I once again, George, will point out that if we want to get to Mars or, you know, start traveling the solar system and settling it and colonizing it, we're going to need to have vessels, ships, that humans can live on maintain when they're millions and millions of miles from Earth.
Or they're cooked.
Or they're cooked, literally sometimes. Yeah. So in this case, this demonstrates that we're not close to that moment yet, even though they did handle it properly, and it was the people on board that handled it entirely. You got to have a very robust technology that is simple enough to not only repair but to keep maintained and doesn't have a lot of complexity, and that's what we need to learn how to do. And ISS gave us at least a glimpse of how we should do that.
Let's go and take some calls, Bob. Kevin in Norwich, Connecticut, welcome to the program. Hello, Kevin.
Oh, George, I love it when you talk space.
Ah, yes.
Kevin, I love it when he talks space also.
You would. Mr. Zimmerman, pleasure to catch you. I have two thoughts to visit with you on and ask you for your feedback. The first is you talked about telescopes watching stars, maybe even stars that are similar to ours for an extended continuous period of time. I gather they don't just take snapshots and wander off to the next star. The telescope has been watching these stars on a continuous basis. And it seems to me that that kind of asset in space, in terms of a telescope, would be valuable also to studying exoplanets, even the exoplanets in that particular star system or solar system that it's watching. The other question I had for you, if you would discuss what is the merit, what is the importance of possibly putting telescopes, for example, on the far side of the moon, or on Mars, where they wouldn't be interfered with by the Earth's atmosphere or light from the Earth, or even telescopes further out in the solar system. We certainly have the technology to feed data streams back very quickly. I don't know how far out we can go. Could we put a telescope on Pluto? I suppose power would be an issue and batteries and so forth. But if you could comment on some of the things we're doing with we could be doing with telescopes that maybe we're not doing.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, what you described about, you know, looking at a specific set of stars continuously for a long period of time, you not only get to study the stars, but you might get to study exoplanets. Well, you just described in less than a paragraph the exact principles behind the Kepler mission. That was exactly what its goal was. It was sent up, it was a small optical telescope, it was looking at a very particular patch of sky, and it was going to do it continuously for a minimum of three years, and it successfully did that. And during that period of time, it studied the variations of those stars in very exquisite detail. And that tells us either there's a transit, a planet moves across the face, and then you can start studying that planet because you can actually get spectroscopy of the planet's atmosphere because the light of the star goes through that atmosphere. But you can also study the variations in the stars themselves because some stars vary not because of planets but because they have sunspots, they have variations, they fluctuate, and you learn a great deal about the planet. So yes, this is absolutely priceless. Bill Borucki, the chief scientist for the Kepler system, fought for years to get Kepler built. For some reason I can never figure out, there seems to be a certain hostility in the astronomy community to the idea of an optical telescopes in space. They resisted Hubble for a few years, but then got on board and helped build it. But then when they got it built, they kind of reluctant to keep it operating. They chose instead to build the James Webb telescope, which is not an optical telescope, it's an infrared telescope. And Kepler itself had some resistance to get funding. An optical telescope in space is actually priceless, and I think absolutely we should build more of them and have a lot of them because we're wired to what we see, and the more we can optically look at, the better we have a clearer understanding of what our other telescopes and other wavelengths tell us. Now, you asked about putting telescopes in other places. Putting a telescope, let's say, in Pluto doesn't really make any sense. There's no reason to get that far away from the sun. You can observe the universe from close in. You have reasons to put telescopes in different places. For example, Webb is going to be infrared. Infrared is basically heat. You want to be able to put that telescope away from heat sources and in a cold spot. And so what they're going to do with Webb is they're going to put it in the Earth's shadow a million miles farther from the sun than the Earth. So it won't be near the Earth, but it'll be in the Earth's shadow. So therefore, the sunlight won't be hitting it. It'll be very cold, and therefore, the only infrared light it gets will be that coming from deep space. Similarly, putting a telescope on the far side of the moon, an optical telescope on the moon might not make sense because you've got a lot of dust problems on the moon. But astronomers have said this for years, that putting a radio telescope on the far side of the moon would make enormous sense because on the far side of the moon, you would get no interference from any of these talk radio shows that go on at 10 o'clock Pacific time every night talking about space. You would get none of that, no interference, so your radio telescope radio wavelengths would be clean and clear, and all you'd be looking at is space. And that's been talked about a great deal. There's some talk about putting a telescope around Mars, but once again, once you get it out of in Earth orbit and above the atmosphere, there's a limited value from getting it too far away. You know, you might want to get it a little bit outside Earth's orbit so that you don't have to deal with the Earth itself getting in the way and daylight, sunlight cycles. But you know, Hubble was in Earth's orbit. It had those issues. But because it was in Earth's orbit, we could reach it easily and maintain it. Webb is going to be a million miles from Earth. If there's anything wrong with the James Webb telescope once it's lost, this $8.5 to $9 billion overspent, very delayed telescope will be junk because we won't have any way to fix it. And so there are pluses and minuses to what you do in that kind of case.
What's the latest on the comet 2013 A1 that could hit Mars?
Oh, well, the last thing I saw on that, George, is that it doesn't look like it's going to hit Mars. It's the last calculations they've got on it, it's going to miss Mars, which is really, from my perspective and from most astronomers' perspective, an enormous disappointment. Because, there's nobody on Mars that could get hit. The odds of it hitting a rover are pretty slim. But we would be able to have seen that happen. And boy, that would have been a show, and it would have been scientifically very valuable. But right now, the calculations say, nope, it's almost certainly not going to hit the planet. So it's too bad. No big show in 2014. You'll have to look at comets for the next year. That's about it.
Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama. It's Jeff's turn, east of the Rockies. Jeff, you're on with Bob Zimmerman.
And I'm kind of disappointed about that, too. But, you know, I seem to remember there's a solar Fossey telescope they were talking about. But one of the things that I was contemplating, you know, there is a lot of hostility. Your guest is right about some of the folks not wanting the, we had a couple of mirrors that were donated to NASA. We had a couple of mirrors that were donated to NASA, and some of the folks acted like they were angry about having them donated. I had an idea of how we might be able to have a private replacement for Kepler. You know, there was a group called Buy This Satellite, and what they wanted to do is provide free data products to folks in South America, which really hurt the telecom companies. So what you might want to do is this, to say, look, either you guys start forking over some money for a private Kepler mission, or we'll give free weather and satellite data to the folks in South America and put you out of business.
Well, you know, if you've listened to me and read my website, Jeff, I am definitely in favor of the idea of private companies doing these kind of things. There is money, I think, to be made putting up private telescopes. There's actually some of those asteroid mining companies are actually going to start out being orbiting telescope companies, building telescopes and renting time on them. So there's money to be made for that. Those National Security Agency mirrors that got donated to NASA is trying to figure out how to use them. They are mirrors comparable to Hubble. But, you know, it's very expensive to build another Hubble telescope, and you have no way to launch it right now or maintain it. We don't have a shuttle anymore. There are proposals. There was one proposal, I mentioned it kind of earlier, of putting one of those mirrors in orbit around Mars and use it to observe Mars as well as maybe the planets nearby. Right now, NASA's problem is they don't really have any money. The Obama administration has slashed the planetary budget and the astrophysics budget. And the astrophysics budget itself is bankrupt because of the James Webb telescope. This was a telescope that was only going to cost $1 billion and be finished by 2010. Well, it now has a budget of $8.5 billion. That's almost nine times more. And it won't get launched till 2018. It has shut down the entire astrophysics department at NASA. Nothing is getting built or launched. And nothing was basically built in the previous decade in astronomy for space. Nothing will be built in this decade in space. They won't even begin to think about building new telescopes in space until next decade, because they've got to finish Webb first. And that's the real tragedy. So NASA doesn't know what to do with those mirrors. It would love to do something, but it's short of money right now.
Okay, a couple more calls here for you. We'll go to Tom in Port Angeles, Washington West. Hey, go ahead, Tom.
Hello, George. Thanks for taking my call. Doc, for years I've wondered why it is that we couldn't get a couple of volunteers to overcome the financial problems of making a round trip every time, and we never talk about volunteers that would be willing to go there one way. I know the arguments are there that the space shuttles can't make it, right? And they're suitable for it. But if we put five or six nodes, space station-type nodes, between two shuttles and spun them once they were on course, okay, we could get there. And the math works out because of the reduced gravity and the size of the planet that they are flyable to a landing. How come we never talk about getting some people that want to go to Mars one way?
Well, there are, Tom, there are proposals right now. Two different private organizations are proposing to send people to Mars. One is being led by Dennis Tito, the first space tourist. He's doing it as a nonprofit, but he's donating the initial funds. The idea there is to send a married couple, they're very particular about that, a married couple on a flyby of Mars, and they want to be able to do it by 2018, which is one of the next orbital arrangements that will allow for a short mission. The other private operation wants to send people almost as a reality show one way to Mars. I am kind of skeptical of both because and I mentioned this when I was talking about the International Space Station. It's not a simple engineering thing to just simply build a ship to go to another planet. You got to recognize the engineering challenges involved. Yep. Werner von Braun said in 1954 that it's going to take us 100 years.
If I could make one more point.
And so I just want to finish that it's going to take 100 years to learn how to build those kind of ships. Now, we're 50 years after he made that prediction, and I think we're right on track in his prediction. This is engineering that's just going to take time to learn how to do. In order to build a ship that you can live a year in space in, you're going to have to live in that ship a year in space first, and better to do that in low Earth orbit. Now, Tom, go ahead. What was your other point?
Well, thanks for letting me throw on a second point, but we've done everything we need to do, at least from my perspective, as far as, understanding how people live in space. And, we've got, thousands of submarine sailors out there that have done, 6, 10, and 12-month patrols submersed.
I want to just cut to the chase. What you have to understand is that we're not just talking about building a vessel in like a submarine. The people who live on that vessel right now have to deal with microgravity, weightlessness, and we have serious medical issues to deal with that. To put any kind of artificial gravity into the equation, you change the engineering completely. And the trouble is that we have no engineering experience at all in creating a spinning craft in space. Every time, in fact, they have tried to do some kind of spinning operation to simulate gravity, they've had significant problems. They've only tried it a handful of times, one on a Soyuz craft back in 71, and once with Gemini crafts back in the 60s, and in both cases, they had technical issues and medical issues that made it not work. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be done, but I just want you to be aware of the, you should, I will say this, go to my website, Behind the Black, and buy, and really, look it up, Leaving Earth, because I did a whole book, it was an award-winning book, I wrote a whole book on the technical, telling the story of building space stations since the first Salyut station back in 71, and with Skylab and Mir, and then with the International Space Station, learning about the technical difficulties and the medical difficulties of trying to build an interplanetary spaceship. You should read that book because you'd really get a feel for what the technical problems are. The people in the space business are very passionate about wanting to do it. The Russians are very aware of how to do it. The Chinese are on the road to trying to do it with their own space stations, but it doesn't mean that just because we're passionate to want to do it, it's a simple thing to do. I really want people to be aware of that.
Outside of the United States and Russia, who is the up-and-coming country in the space?
Well, right now, the countries I like to always point to is either China or India. India is the most interesting because they have a government program, but it's a program unlike any other in the world. It's kind of similar to the Russians in that its focus is to get market share and make money. The Chinese are copying the Soviet Union style, which is just publicity stunts and public relations.
Mm-hmm.
But the Indians are interested in getting market share, creating rockets that they can sell as a launch service.
Where are they getting the money to do all this?
Well, the profit. They think in terms of profit. In about a decade and a half ago, India abandoned the communist model and decided to copy the United States to become a capitalist country. And since then, their economy is booming. So there's lots of wealth, and that reduces a great deal of tax dollars. And so their government has a surplus. So the government is investing money in this space program, but with the proviso that the program produce rockets that can be sold on the open market competitively to make money. And they eventually want to transfer this to private enterprise. They don't want to have it a government operation. You do that, you put yourself out there, and you're actually creating a very robust and vibrant industry, and therefore you become very competitive. China, you know, has done some remarkable stuff. They actually do have a manned mission this summer. They've done the only other country besides the United States and Russia that has launched human beings into space. But they have a very leisurely approach, and it's for public relations mostly. And so anyone who wants to compete with them is going to beat them because their pace is so slow.
Robert, my friend, always good to talk with you. His book, Genesis, The Story of Apollo 8, up next, The Treasure of the Mind.